Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is Monday, February 17, 2025, and we do have a quorum present. First bill up, Senate File 737. Senator Nelson, second author on the bill, is going to be presenting on behalf of Senator Housley, the chief author. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be here. Thank you for hearing the bill and to the committee as well. And I do want to thank Senator Housley for authoring, and I'm glad to be a second author on this. This bill is about mandatory fines for school bus arm violations. I'm going to just give you a couple facts just to kind of set the stage, and then I'll do a quick walkthrough of the bill. But in Minnesota, there are thousands of school bus stop arm violations every year. And we know that that puts students at risk. Stronger penalties, we believe, will reduce repeat offenders and help keep children safe. And also, I always think it's important to know legislative precedent. Other states that have stricter penalties have actually seen a decline in violations. That's what we are hoping to do with this bill. As you know, currently, when an individual is convicted of violating a school bus stop arm, there's a variety of potential punishments. Well, actually, only two. misdemeanor and a mandatory minimum fine of no less than $500. Or if they're trying to pass around the right hand of the school bus, where that is very dangerous, or when a child is outside of this or on the street of an adjacent sidewalk, that's also a gross misdemeanor with a mandatory fine of $500. The problem is this: it doesn't matter if there's 100 repeats, 100 times a person would not stop at a school bus stop arm. The problem is, there's no mandatory minimum for repeat offenses. And so that's what this bill does, basically. You can look, just a quick bill walkthrough on line 1.7 through 1.11. This bill just establishes increasing fines, not penalties, increasing fines for repeat offenses within a 10-year period. You'll see $500 for the first violation, which is now for every violation. This bill would make the second violation within 10 years $700 fine. And the third or subsequent violation within 10 years, $950 fine. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Eric Simonson.
Mr. Simonson, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Simonson. I represent the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, otherwise known as the MSBOA. We represent Minnesota's privately owned school bus contractors and have done so since 1948. MSBOA provides over 60% of the school buses used to transport Minnesota's children to and from school-related activities. And we're responsible for over 400,000 students transported over 230,000 miles every school day. MSBOA has consistently been a driving force behind Minnesota's stop arm law and has recognized the challenges between the number of stop arm violations and the actual prosecution numbers. This challenge in part led to the creation of the Stop Arm Camera Grant Program, providing cameras that generate evidence of violations in Minnesota, largely credited with helping to reduce repeat stop arm violators by providing this critical video evidence, much less of a they say, we say scenario. We believe that any reasonable step that can be taken to continue reducing either initial violations of Minnesota's stop arm law or reducing repeat offenses will in fact save lives of Minnesota school children going forward. There is no single solution that eliminates tragic accidents involving children boarding or exiting the school bus. Rather, we believe it is a multifaceted effort that must continue. There are too many distracted drivers on the roads today, and if there are steps that we can take that will reduce the chances for future tragedies or recidivism, we are in support of those steps. We appreciate Senator Housley's efforts toward this bill. We appreciate Senator Nelson presenting this bill today, and the MSBOA stands in full support of Senate File 737.
Thank you, Mr. Simonson. Senator Nelson, any other testifiers you have?
I do not have another testifier. I do have a couple closing comments.
Okay. Anyone else in the room present wish to testify in connection with this bill? Any questions or comments from members of the committee about this bill? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Nelson, maybe you or your testifier could tell me, how often is there a repeat offender on a violation of a school bus?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. While there's been over 1,000 violations, we know now that there have been 23 times that there's been a second violation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
In how long of a time period is that?
Well, I don't have that information, but I might be able to call a witness who does. Testifier, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I treat them all the same.
I know that.
With whatever deference they are due. Go ahead and identify yourself.
Lieutenant Brian Ruth of Minnesota State Patrol, specifically with our Office of Pupil Transportation Safety. Mr. Lieutenant. Chair, Senator Limmer, and members, the 23 was since 2015. In preparation for the Transportation Hearing Committee, I asked the court records to get that information.
So, Mr. Chair, in a 10-year period of time, there's been 23 instances where people have been caught and convicted, and as a result, they're repeat offenders on a bus stop violation. Is that correct?
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, that's correct. Those are that's the number of repeat convictions that the court records had on file.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to confirm that because I was looking at the fiscal note and it doesn't seem like there's much of a cost at all recognized, and just curious. I'm kind of concerned about the fine, though. It seems like it's a rather low fine for the seriousness of the offense, and especially if it's a second violation. So, Senator Nelson, do you know why Senator Housley has arrived at that dollar amount, or perhaps the sponsors of the bill made a suggestion, and it's now in the through the revisor's office and in front of us now?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, I do not know how these particular increased penalties were determined, what the amount is. I do think it's fair to say that all of us agree, or we all agree on the safety of children, and I'm glad to see the movement to increase those fines. And Senator Housley might entertain amendments that increase them further, but I can't really speak to why we are at these particular levels, except to note that the fines should be increased for repeat offenders.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, maybe you could help me out. A person that would be a first-time DWI offense, do you know what that fine potential would be? I'm just trying to gain a scale between two rather dangerous driving offenses and trying to determine if this figure here in front of us is appropriate or not.
Senator Limmer, on a first-time DWI with a less than 0.16 test result, it's a misdemeanor-level offense. The maximum penalty under law for all misdemeanors is $1,000.
Okay. All right.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, or your testifier, Mr. Simonson, how many violators that have been caught doing this end up actually paying this type of fine?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Lieutenant Brainer.
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator. So looking at court records is traditionally typically around 1,000 to 1,200 charges for stop-arm violations a year. Last year in 2024, there was over 1,800. We think that was significant. Increase was due to the stop-arm cameras that were installed. But of those that are charged, it's about a 50 to 55% conviction rate. So just over half of those that actually get convicted of the stop arm violation. Some of them may take some sort of lesser plea to something lesser or just dismissed altogether.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Lieutenant, do the 50 or 55% actually end up paying even though they've been convicted? Are some that don't have the money to pay?
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, members, the statute sets the minimum fine. The courts don't always hold them to that, so that's going to be up to the discretion of the court process of what the actual payment that the violator pays.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
So, Lieutenant, then these people that have been convicted, are they again considered coming back for being re-violating the stop arm situation? Have they been reconvicted of their crime of not yielding to the stop arm and again not paying the fine on this? Do you know that statistically?
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I don't have the stats on who pled to something less and then committed again. The repeat numbers that we got for the 23 was strictly just the violation of the statute 169.444. So if they pled to something lower that went on the record, court records wouldn't have been able to see that.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, in the past, there was a time when we fined the automobile, because that's how we detected the violator or the perceived violator. But now we're talking about fining the driver. So that requires investigation to determine who the driver is, and I would imagine that a lot of these cases, the person who really was the driver would deny that they were the driver, so someone would have to either get a picture of the violator or some other method of determining who the driver is. Is that a problem with getting these convictions?
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, that is always a challenge with the prosecuting side of it, is having that clear evidence that you know the vehicle that was stopped or what went through the stop arm violation, and you identified the driver, and essentially certainly helps if the driver admits it, but as you alluded, a lot of times they're going to deny that. So you have the bus driver's observations and what they can get from a description of the driver. Now with the cameras, it does help potentially get that still shot or the video shot of the driver going through it, and then just whatever evidence that law enforcement can find. So that does make it challenging, and I would imagine that's a part of the reason why a lot of them do get pled down, just because it can be difficult to get that conviction just on the face of it.
Senator Carlson.
And Mr. Chair and Lieutenant, when we look at a gross misdemeanor, it has to have some sort of intention behind it. Is that what gets pled down? Is that, it was an accident, I didn't know I had to stop. And that gets pled down to a misdemeanor, perhaps the person will admit it, that it's a misdemeanor, admit that it was a violation if they get to a misdemeanor. Is that what happens also in court?
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, members, that certainly does, is a possibility. Again, that's all up to the agreements between the prosecutor and the defense, the defendant, how they want to proceed. If they feel that, hey, at least we can get a conviction that way, it may allow them to lessen it down that way. But like you alluded to, the gross misdemeanor ones, at least when it comes to the school bus ones, it's not just because it's a gross misdemeanor because it's second, it's a gross misdemeanor because either went by the right side of the bus, passing that entrance door where kids are getting off, or they went by the bus while the kid's standing outside or potentially in the street. So I would think the prosecutors would be less likely to make those deals, but that is all up to their prosecutorial discretion.
Senator Carlson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And a further question on that is that do prior violations come into play when you're talking about a repeat offender. So if someone has had a violation that might be 5 years ago, is that when they do it again, is that now that 10-year looking back, is that in effect so that they can be charged with the higher fine because they're a repeat offender?
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, members, that's all up to the court's decision and the judge's decision, what they want to do. So the fine, they certainly have the ability to look at the offender's driving record and see if there's been any other concerning driving behavior or other repeat offenses, or the prosecutor may pull that into play, but that is all through the court process.
Mm-hmm. Senator Carlson. And
one more question, Mr. Chair. A lot of people don't know the rules of violating a stop arm, whether there's a median in the street, whether there's multiple lanes, all of that sort of thing. Is there any effort on the, I'm not sure who would take charge of this, but in the driver's manual and in the instructions that people get where and when the stops have to be made. For instance, if you're in the same directional lane as the school bus, it's obvious, but if you're on an oncoming lane and you don't have a median, then I believe it's a little bit murky as to whether it applies or not. And if there is a median, I think that that's excusable to go on through because you don't have the direct effect on that lane. Am I correct in that?
Lieutenant.
And I want to say one more thing is that are we making sure that this is included in the 55 Alive classes as well? Because a lot of these things do change over the years. So I want to make sure that we do have that kind of instruction in the 55 Alive classes.
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, members, the State Patrol does put a priority to try to do the education and public outreach on this. We did create a 30-second PSA video a few years back that had some of those visual graphics of, as you mentioned, the non-divided highways and the divided highways. We also did more of a, I think it was 5 to 8 minute session training that could be used to supplement the required curriculum for the driver's ed courses. There is at least 30 minutes that's required to be covered in driver's training to talk about the importance of stop arm violations. I'm unaware on the 55 Alive curriculum what's required in that, but I do know that it is required to be taught to the students that take the driver's ed. We did, I believe it was $50,000 last year from the legislature that we received to do some school bus awareness safety outreach that we had a firm put together some ad campaigns for us for that as well. So we do what we can with what we have to try to get that messaging out there.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate Counsel is going to offer us some additional information. Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Carlson asked earlier about the whole idea of holding the owner of the vehicle liable. And we do that for certain traffic crimes, and this is one of them. So it's a petty misdemeanor for the owner of a motor vehicle that's been used in violation of the law. However, if the actual driver winds up getting convicted, then the owner may not be fined. So it's kind of one or the other. And that's a payable offense. It's a $100 fine and a $75 surcharge. So the owner would be out $175 for that.
I'm going to offer a few additional thoughts based on my observations and experience. One is that there's no intent requirement for a gross misdemeanor. The definition of gross misdemeanor is a maximum penalty that's allowed. Some of them have mens rea or intent components, some don't. This one does not. So they are subject to 364 days in jail and a $3,000 fine is a maximum for a gross misdemeanor. That's how you define the level of offense. Secondly, there is no statutory component right now for repeat offenders. So this would add additional consequences for repeat offenders. That doesn't mean prosecutors don't take that into consideration in deciding how to handle cases. I would tell you, whatever they get fined in court, by far the biggest financial consequence for someone who gets convicted of this is the increase in their own insurance premiums. No fine in court's going to come anywhere close to that. So there is, I think, a lot of confusion out there as to when it is mandatory to stop. As you said, Senator Carlson, it's pretty important, pretty well known if you're following a school bus and the lights come on and the stop arm goes out, you got to stop for that. But if you're on a divided roadway and there's a median, you know, what are your obligations? I think a lot of people don't know what the answer is. And for a lot of people, 10, 20, 30, 40 years removed from their driver's ed classes, probably have no idea. I can tell you from personal observation, most of them have no idea. I think what we have now, the best thing we've done is the cameras. because it's easier to hold people accountable for the conduct, to identify the driver, and to prove what they've done when it gets into court. However, the prosecutors do exercise a lot of discretion here. There are a lot of people who come in and they take safe driving classes before they show up in court, or they do that either on their own or on advice of counsel before coming into court, and the prosecutors decide that is a sufficient reminder of the law, especially for the misdemeanor level offenses, which happens if there are no children outside the school bus. Sometimes people get charged, and it shows up on the video, when there just simply was not enough time for them to actually stop between when the they drive past the school bus and when the stop arms go out and the lights come on. So if someone's traveling at roadway speed of 30 miles an hour and they've got exactly 1 second to come to a complete stop, you can watch on the camera as they're driving past the bus with the lights on and the arm out, telling them to stop, but there's no physical way they could have come to a stop, yet they've been charged. So there are a lot of reasons why there is discretion exercised by the prosecutors in how to handle these cases, and probably by the prosecutors and the courts in deciding what level of fine is the right financial penalty for it. The only other thing I'm going to add is that there have been, 23 violations of repeat offenders out of 6,822 in the last 10 years. So my handy calculator on my phone says it's a 0.3% of people who repeat violate, which tells me that they've been convicted the first time, and as a practical matter, they never do it again. They simply never do it again. Whether it's a function of inattention the first time or not knowing the rules of the road the first time or feeling like they couldn't safely stop. The bus driver's not going to let kids out until after the bus driver at least observes the traffic around the driver and the bus having come to a stop. So if someone's at that point running the lights with kids out, they've been completely paying no attention or they don't care. And that's a gross misdemeanor offense for which they could be put in jail. For almost a year. My personal view is these minimum fines would have absolutely zero impact on preventing future offenses. For those who are intentionally violating the law, it's the likelihood of being caught. That matters to them far more than any minimum fines, and they're certainly not going to know about the minimum fines anyway. It's going to be an after-the-fact punishment, and if the idea there is to prevent them from doing it again, the statistics show they don't need minimum fines to not do it again. They'll not do it again because they don't want to have the consequences of doing it again. Plain and simple, that's what the statistics show us. So, while every one of us wants to protect kids, I'm not a big fan of taking steps under the law that are going to have zero impact, in my assessment. As a practical matter, and frankly forces courts and prosecutors into a position of whether they are going to be ignoring a statute as a practical matter, because so many people can't afford a $500 or a $700 or a $950 fine. So my intention here is to lay the matter over for possible inclusion. Not in our bill. It's a transportation bill of original jurisdiction, and the Transportation Committee referred it over here because we have some dual jurisdiction in this one. So they'll make a decision how they want to handle it. But my inclination right now is, after we're done with our conversation, is to lay it over. Transportation Committee will make a decision on whether they wish to include it in their final omnibus package. That said, are there any further questions or comments before we go ahead and do that? And then we'll give Senator Nelson a chance for closing remarks. Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do believe this will help enhance student safety, and I do think that this will be helpful in those repeat offenders, whether they know about the fine or not. But what I would say is, I thought Senator Carlson's comment about 55 alive was very important. As you know, I think it was last year, maybe the year before, I carried that legislation that increased your insurance discount if you do take that 55 alive class. I will follow up with them. I haven't taken that yet, probably should, but I will follow up and make that suggestion. I think that's a very, very good suggestion. I would say other, just recounting a legislative precedent from other states that have seen a decline in violations, I think this bill will help support public safety priority, helping ensure children's safety near school buses. Like you said, it's a top concern for all of us. I do believe it's fair and proportionate. The fines escalate based on repeated offenses and hopefully appropriate consequences. I'm glad to see the community support, parents, school, law enforcement, backing these stricter violations. So thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Senator Nelson. Senate File 737 is laid over. All right. Senate File 505, Senator Muhammad. Okay. So members, the plan here, if it reaches the approval of the committee, is to send it onto the Senate floor from here. Senator Muhammad, welcome back to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is good to be back in this committee. And I would like to start with the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, so I can get the bill from the committee in the shape that I would like it to be.
So members, this is the first stop for the committee. This is an author's amendment. Senator Seeberger moves adoption of the A1 amendment to Senate File 505. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Muhammad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year, I carried a bill which passed that made major reforms to our contract for deed law. This bill was in response to widespread publicity about the predatory practices that investors and speculators were engaging in against all contract for deed buyers, especially those in the Somali and Latino communities. This bill sought to separate individual mom-and-pop sales from sales made by those in the contract for deed business to individuals. To accomplish this, we exempted a variety of transactions from the new provisions. For example, contracts for deed sold by one family member to another was exempted. Over the interim, we identified several errors and omitted words. In addition, we identified two additional categories of sales that we should exempt. This bill is primarily technical. The two substantive changes are the state and political subdivisions, and also sole owner and LLC, whose owner is a natural person otherwise exempt. This bill has been vetted with the stakeholders from last year's bill. Among them are the Minnesota Association of Realtors, the Minnesota State Bar Association, the Minnesota Land Trust Association, and the Minnesota Bank Associations and the credit unions. I have Ron Elwood and Larry, who will also testify and help answer questions.
Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank Senator Muhammad for bringing this technical bill forward. And Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing it. I really don't have much to add. I really appreciate all the work that's been done. I would just say to the amendment, it simply changes some effective dates at the behest of the Minnesota Association of Realtors, with whom we've worked last year and this year, and want to express our appreciation to them for their collaboration and help on getting this bill passed. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I'd like to turn over to Mr. Wertheim.
Mr. Wertheim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Larry Wertheim. The bill basically corrects a number of typos that occurred near the when certain modifications were made near the end of the last session. The only real substantive change is to expand the exemption from for investor sellers, people or entities that are not subject to the investor seller rules, and actually those exemptions arose as a result of some lectures I've given over the many months here, where people came up and said, "Hey, Hennepin County does this. Why aren't we exempted?" And so we thought that's the reason for the political subdivision exemption. They sell tax-exempt property on contract for deed, and it didn't seem appropriate to classify them as investor sellers. So that the rest are really just conforming amendments or correcting typos that occurred near the end in some last-minute changes in the bill last year.
Thank you, Mr. Wertheim. Anyone else in the room want to testify in connection with the bill? Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mohammed, I guess listening to your explanation, what is the problem we're really trying to fix here? I'm not really following. What's the problem we're actually trying to fix in this bill?
Senator Mohammed.
Thank you, Chair Latz. Senator Westrum, this is a bill we passed last session for contract for deed. And this bill that is in front of us is currently making two changes, which are we are exempting sales made by the state or political divisions. And like Larry said, it's like folks like Hennepin County. And then we're also exempting sales by a single owner, LLC individuals.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Mohammed, does the state of Minnesota sell on contract for deeds to people or counties?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wertheim.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we didn't really think so, but I was contacted by a Hennepin County attorney who said, yeah, we sell on contracts for deed. We sell tax forfeited land on contract for deed, and we should have been exempted. And I said, well, it's news to us, but that's really the genesis of that very change.
And so, Mr.
Senator
Chair, I guess what's the reason we would exempt them from what other private parties have to do? Or does it beg the question that maybe we should not require this process for everybody else?
Mr. Wertheim.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator. The basic, we already exempt banks and savings and loans and other institutions regulated by the Department of Commerce. And and again, we exempt a sale to a family member. We also exempt someone who's lived and occupied the property for a year. The whole idea is to get, and where the abuse was possibly found is where we had strangers to the property, investors bought the property and flipped it. And then, and there was felt to be, there was uneven bargaining power between the parties. That really isn't present where you have the state or a political subdivision or a city selling it on a contract for deed. That's not their business. So we didn't feel that disclosure by those entities was necessary, the same as we don't require disclosure by a bank or a savings association regulated by the Department of Commerce or the federal government.
Senator Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is relating to the language stricken on lines 1.18 and 19. And we had a brief conversation before this started, but if you could elaborate, what was the purpose for the stricken language in the first place in the bill last year?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Croon, the first section of this bill was actually come from the Bar Association, Minnesota State Bar Association. And they asked us to carry this bill, this provision last year. The language that was stricken was never in the bill in the first place. And it somehow magically emerged at the after the conference committee was signed, sealed, and delivered, and the bill was passed into law. And we discovered it last year. The bar talked to us and said, you know, this was not supposed to be in here. This wasn't our language. It somehow got in there, I think, because it's conforming to a later provision that requires recording within 4 months under the contract, the present contract for deed law, and the one we revised last year. So it was simply, it mysteriously emerged, and we're unmysteriously taking it out.
Mr. Wortham, yes.
This was another one in giving another lecture. Attorney from the Department of Revenue came up to me and said, why'd you put that language in there? And that was the first time, about 3 months after the bill had been passed, that any of us saw it. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why. And then I realized that those four or five words were added to the recording provision, and someone dumped it in here at the same time. They put it in twice. They should have, once in the right place and once in the wrong place.
Senator Croon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. I was uncertain about that myself. I couldn't quite figure out why that was in there, but I guess I'm glad it's being taken out now. My next question is on page 6, 6.22, to be exact. It's talking about the seller's ownership interest, and my question is how will that be confirmed? Because it's not going to be evident from the real estate records whether or not an ownership of the entity was sold.
Mr. Wortham.
Chair, Senator, the reason that language is in there is in largely because of the addition of Part 13, which allows, we wanted to allow someone who is otherwise qualified to be exempt from being a investor seller to incorporate themselves because it, for liability reasons and stuff like that, to sell on a contract for deed. If you were a mom and pop and you wanted to incorporate yourself or create an LLC to sell on a contract for deed, this new section 13 allows it. C is, and I'll get to your question in a little bit because it's kind of have to get a little bit into the weeds here, but C is directed at the situation where at simultaneously with the sale, the otherwise qualified non-investor seller then flips it to a real investor seller. And under the original language, that's prohibited. What we also want to do is, since we could create, we now allowed an LLC to be an investor, a non-investor seller, that someone could not just transfer the memberships in that LLC to a person that really was an investor seller. You're absolutely right. It doesn't appear in the real estate records, but no one needs to examine title to determine whether this has happened or not. This has no effect on title. It's just a question of, can a buyer, a contract for deed buyer, later make a claim that there's been a violation of the act because, in fact, it was an investor seller and they didn't do the disclosure as required. And so this says, yeah, you can't do the flip and use a transfer of the ownership interest as part of the flip, the same way you can't just mom and pop transfer to an investor and say, oh, simultaneously with selling on the contract for deed, and say, oh, it's not an investor-seller transaction. Again, we just wanted to make sure that we didn't leave a loophole to allow others. But no one needs to examine title. It's not a question of title. It's a question of, is there a claim for violation of the Investor-Seller Act?
Senator Croom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation. So basically what I'm hearing you saying, this is just simply a fact that could be determined at some point, likely later, that gives rise to a claim, but it isn't gonna be apparent from looking at the real estate records.
Mr. Wirtha.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you're absolutely correct. There's no reason to, and no one needs to examine whether it's an investor-seller contract or not. Actually, the only issue is if in the cancellation process, sometimes the investor-seller issue will come up. But we've addressed that in the bill last year by providing for affidavits and certifications in the contract form, and everyone can be certain on the face of the contract, people can rely on what's been recorded.
Senator Croom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also appreciate the amendment, because I had a problem with the effective dates, but I think they've all been changed. And I think the reason that's important is because you need some time for practitioners and realtors and everybody to change their forms and everything. And I don't think it's practical at all for this to be effective the day following enactment. My question is, did the author's amendment cover all of those effective dates?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruen, it covered all but the first two sections, because the first one shouldn't have been there in the first place. And the second section two, it's simply an incorrect cross-reference to a subdivision. But all the rest follow with your concern and the realtor's concern that people need a little time to even digest technical changes. And so we appreciated the realtors coming forward with that amendment, or seeking that amendment. And of course, we're happy to do it.
Senator Croom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation. I think that's probably fine if especially on the first part, if it was a mistake there in the first place. I can't think of any reason why that one couldn't be effective immediately. And same with the cross-reference part. The rest of my comments on this, I think the changes are good changes. I still have serious problems with the underlying bill that was passed last year and what the implications of that law change are going to be on contract for deeds. But I suppose that's a discussion that we can continue to have offline, because I practiced, I've used contract for deeds a lot. I think it's a really important vehicle to encourage and promote home ownership for people who do not qualify or cannot qualify for mortgage financing. And I don't think we ever want to lose sight of that. The ultimate question should be this: how does this support the public policy of increasing home ownership? And I have really serious concerns that the changes that were made last year promote that public policy. I know there's some bad actors out there, and we want to do what we can to make sure that they're not taking advantage of people, but at the same time, you can't lose sight of the overarching goal, which is to promote home ownership. And I think perhaps the pendulum swung a little too far. We've talked about some changes. I think the 10% in 550, it's not in this bill, but in 559A.04 subdivision 5, increasing that down payment that the vendor can retain a little bit above 10%, I think would go a long way towards satisfying some of my biggest concerns with this. I think that's an incredibly small percentage when you think about all of the things that a vendor might have to do or pay for or damage to property. There's just not a lot of margin there. So to me, that is something we need to look on, and I'd be interested, as long as you're here, Mr. Wertheim, and in your seminars and things as you're going out over the next several months, things that I would like to know and maybe follow up with you are what this change is doing to the number of investor sellers. Are there more or less, or is it unaffected? That would be something I'd want to know. How many Vendi victims that you're identifying, both before the law change and after the law change, and what that's looking like. You know, and I don't know if there's any way to measure this, but about, you know, but the number of families that are in apartments or mobile homes that, you know, that are purchasing homes on a contract for deed, if that number is changing, you know, I think that's something that we should monitor. We shouldn't just assume that all of these changes are good. We should look at the effects of them and see if they're having the intended effect. And so that's another thing. And, you know, how many have not been able to buy a house because of this law? I don't know if there's a way to measure that, but that would be something I would be interested in. And then the other final thing, Mr. Chair, is the definition of churning on page 5. You know, one thing you might want to consider if we are, and this isn't an original thought of mine, but I'll repeat it. You know, if we are heading towards a foreclosure crisis, contract for deeds become a much more important real estate tool. And I'm wondering if that provision could be suspended if mortgage interest rates go above a certain percentage. At that point, I think it would be more important from a public policy standpoint to encourage these contract for deeds and the cancellation of the contract for deeds to get more homes on the market in a scenario like that. So those are my thoughts, and I know they don't pertain directly to the amendments here today, so I'm not going to ask questions or offer any amendments or anything like that. But as we're going forward over the next several months, those are the things that I would be looking at and like to work with you all on some of those issues as well. So thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Wirth, I just have on our record that you're here as a counsel for Kennedy and Graven. Are you representing any particular group of people as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator? No, I don't represent anyone. It's just my interest in contracts for deed.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your testimony here today. Any other questions?
Sorry.
Senator Kroon, you've reached your limit.
I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
I'm kidding, Senator Kroon. It's nice to have a resident real estate attorney on the committee.
On the issue we talked about before with it not being in the real estate records on page, is that again? Page 6.22. I get what you're saying, but I'm just wondering, and maybe you can help me with this, would there be any reason why it would need to be known in the real estate records from a title examination perspective after the fact to ensure that there aren't any problems, or do you have any concerns about that?
Mr. Wirthout.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator, not really. I mean, it's kind of self-regulating in that we've provided in the statute passed last year that a statement in the contract for deed that the contract is not a residential real property, or is not, even if residential real property, is not, the seller is not an investor seller. It's prima facie evidence. So that allows everyone examining title to say, I don't have to be concerned about any of these provisions and any of these other rules. We've already kind of addressed that issue and made a blanket exemption. So as long as you put it in the record. Now, sometimes people won't even put it in the contract. We've even provided that if in connection with a cancellation, you haven't stated that, you can file an affidavit. And that also is prima facie evidence, so for the real estate record. So I think we've covered the real estate record, and no one really needs to be concerned about who is the owner. As long as it's not an investor-seller contract, it's not an investor-seller contract.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm hearing is that as long as somebody hasn't started an action and recorded a notice of lis pendens, the title examiner doesn't have to worry about this and can basically ignore whether there's been any violations underneath the title record.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elwood.
One final thing. I just want to reiterate that we did run this by the Minnesota Land Title Association, and they had no concerns.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, either of the counselors, can you remind me, so what is the statute of limitations for the claim? And basically, it's the buyer that would have to be able to raise the claim. Is it 2 years or what is the statute?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Senator, Worthen.
It's 2 years.
2 years.
2 years. And so, also there's protection if there's a, if the contract is assigned and the party buying the seller's interest doesn't have any knowledge of it, and there's no lis pendens, then the claim is barred even if the 2 years hasn't elapsed. There's a holder in due course protection.
Okay, so
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, if the assignments occurred or if the cancellations occurred prior to 2 years, the buyer's right to raise the claim is barred? Is that basically how it works?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, Worthen. Basically upon cancellation, the claim is barred. If you cancel, it doesn't survive cancellation. You can raise it as a defense to cancellation. It's a basis to get an injunction against cancellation because that buyer's got a claim under the statute. But if no claim is made and the cancellation is completed, the title is clear and life goes on.
And Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. So when this law originally passed, it was, I think, an exemption of 3 or less sales in a year by the same entity. Is that still a part of the exemptions?
Mr. Worthen.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that was under the old multiple seller statute, where if you got the fifth sale in a year period, then it triggered certain disclosure requirements. And that was adopted 12 years ago, I think. That whole law was repealed effective last August 1st and replaced with the new statute. Basically, the idea is that if you're an investor seller, you got to comply no matter how many sales you've had. The first sale triggers investor seller requirements if you're an investor seller. So that the fourth or fifth sale rule doesn't apply to this new statute that was adopted last year.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Senator Westrom, would you like to move the bill?
Sure. Well, I don't know if I want to move it, but I actually have another question.
Giving you an opportunity. Senator Kroon, do you want to move the bill?
So, first question, Mr. Chair. Just to
Senator
kind of
Westrom,
tie a bow on this, what's the common relief? They undo the deal and the buyer can get out of it, or is the buyer typically wanting something different?
Mr. Worthen.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I mean, the remedy under the statute, which is modeled on a virtually identical Iowa statute, which has a very is the only other state with a similar cancellation process to Minnesota, and that's why we kind of adopted that. It's a rescission. You undo the entire transaction. Buyer gets back everything they paid, and gives up the property. And it's got to be done. So file the action within 2 years. Basically, undo the transaction. And it's somewhat similar to some of the common law remedies for rescission that the courts will sometimes allow under certain very limited circumstances.
Senator Uma Verbet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to move the bill. I move that Senate File 505, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor.
All those in favor of the motion say aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Bill is on its way to the floor. Senator Muhammad, better be prepared for the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Never a dull moment in this committee.
All right, there being no further business to come before the committee, I'll just note that we are meeting on Wednesday, 12:30 p.m. here in this very room. With that, we are adjourned.